Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and today I'm happy to have with me Wayne Johnston. He's a Canadian writer whose first books are being published in America. He's written five books that were published in Canada. Here we've got his most recent, The Colony of Unrequited Dreams, and coming out virtually simultaneously is an early book written 10 years ago called The Divine Ryans. One is from Doubleday, the other from the paperback division of Doubleday Anchor Books. I wanted to begin by asking you about that kind of lapse and what it's like to be published in, as you say, the country your father called the country north of Mexico.
Yeah, my father called it that because, it was a kind of, not a put-down exactly of America, but he had heard Canada so often called the country north of the United States, so that's where he got that. Divine Ryans was published in 1990 in Canada. And one of the reasons, actually the reason it didn't get published in the States, is that my publisher bought world rights and then didn't try to sell them anywhere else. But it's strange to have, you know, a Publisher's Weekly review appeared recently of Divine Ryans. It's strange to have a 10-year-old book reviewed, you know, and especially, you know, it's not in translation. It's still in English. It's still exactly the same book that it was. But it's also very gratifying. But you can't help thinking, why not 10 years ago? You know, if they like it this much now, why didn't they like it that much then, you know?
Well, it's an interesting thing because once a book gets passed, you know, it will only be, in the case of The Divine Ryans, a movie or a big new novel that bears a chance of resurrecting it, and we lose a lot of opportunity to discover literature that way. Now, these books are on a certain kind of, I would say, 19th century model, a story in which secrets are revealed.
There is that. It's a kind of playing around with the 19th century kind of Dickensian premise. You know, at the end of a book, someone finds out that the woman next door is really his mother or something like that. But I don't think they're, especially not Divine Ryans, but even Colony of Unrequited Dreams, I don't think they're really written in a 19th century tradition. There are a lot of things, and we'll probably get into them, in Colony of Unrequited Dreams that are very definitely, 20th century types of writing that you would never find in Thackeray or Dickens or, you know, whatever.
But I'm thinking in particular, one of the pleasures in both books is the discovery, and I rarely see them in contemporary novels, of secret documents and codes and secrets tucked away. Yeah. In one case, on the cover of the book, an impression. In one case, within a dedication to a book. And so the bookiness of the books is very pleasurable.
Yeah. Well, Colony of Unrequited Dreams, one of its themes is history. And when it deals with contemporary history of Newfoundland, my notion is that history is written in a kind of code. They say it's written by the winners. This book is in part about who gets to write history, who gets written about, and who gets access to read history. And, I think that history is written in a kind of code that you have to crack. And the idea being, to find out what the truth is about the past. And so in Colony of Unrequited Dreams, there is a letter sent to a school where the main character, Smallwood, goes to. And it's attributed to him, but it's cut out of some unknown document, letters pasted onto the page. And, incriminating him in an act that, not to give it away, but that in fact he didn't commit. That doesn't give everything away. So, you know, that's the idea, and it turns out that it was, you know, cut out of a history book, you know, Proust's History of Newfoundland. So that's one of the things I'm getting at is the encoding of the truth in history, the unreliableness of history and the written record.
Well, to some extent, history is the history of the oppressor. Yeah. And history, as Stephen Dedalus says, is a nightmare from which I am trying to awake. Mm. This book, early on, a schoolmaster threatens the young Joey Smallwood, the hero, a man, in fact, drawn from history. He's the person who confected the confederation mm-hmm. that made Newfoundland a province of Canada.
Yeah.
He's ruefully scolded that what he probably wants, reading these difficult books that he carries around with him, is to be a Tolstoy mm-hmm. Of the as yet unwritten and unchartered province. To what degree is it still unwritten and unchartered?
Well, you know, Headmaster Reeves is not entirely wrong when he makes that accusation of Smallwood. He's wrong in scorning the idea that someone would try to do that, that Smallwood would be presumptuous enough to think that a novel based on Newfoundland could be as great as War and Peace. And as far as whether or not this place has been written about or this history has been written about, Newfoundland is just beginning to be written about, especially its history. For a long time, because of the nature of the referendum of 1948, it was so controversial. The margin of victory was so absurdly small, 7,000 votes, which means 3,500 the other way, and Newfoundland would still be an independent country. Because of all that, it's taken, I think, this is my view of it, the two generations that have passed to put enough distance between us and the referendum that we can write about it without being on one of the two soapboxes about whether or not we should or shouldn't have joined Canada. And we're able to write about it now in a literary fashion and, ring variations on history in the manner of historical fiction.
The book, ironical as it is, that it reminded me most of in its way was The Sotweed Factor, an American mm-hmm. novel that's yep. about the, in a sense, the defeat of innocence mm-hmm. and the idea that the heaven of the Baltimore colony is in fact a pit of corruption, disease, and slime, mm-hmm. something that the second main character in the colony of Unrequited Dreams, my guest Wayne Johnston, makes abundantly clear in her interleaved, mm-hmm. Informal history of Newfoundland. And it's her, she's on happy terms with pestilence, in a sense. She revels in the presentation of the place as being a hard place defeating the human instinct.
Somewhat. Fielding's layers of irony are sometimes, you unravel one and you sometimes get to another. It's not totally to the point of John Barth where the writing subverts the message, and what the writing ultimately is all about is the sort of pointlessness of writing. Sometimes Barth reads like that. Fielding, she's a journalist who also writes she writes a newspaper column and writes journal entries, letters, and a condensed history of Newfoundland, actually, which all of which appear in the book. And her take on Newfoundland is, ostensibly the one of the traditional satirist, but she takes on a kind of she subverts the role of the satirist in a way, because her intention is to sort of, at least in the condensed history, take on the voice of a crank who is telling Newfoundland history from the point of view of the English, and sort of dumping on the colonials. So, my view of Fielding as I wrote the book evolved from Fielding being a straight satirist to Fielding being the best kind of satirist, a kind of Swiftian one, which is a satirist who is an idealist at heart. And those are the most interesting ones to me. Fielding's father's epitaph is Swift's epitaph. He is gone where savage indignation can lacerate his heart no more. That's Fielding's view of the world is not what it seems at first glance to either the characters, other characters in the book, or to the reader. You have to take her all the way to the end. In that, it's a kind of soliloquy or monologue of hers that ends the book, where I think she finds her truest voice in the last 30 pages of the book.
Now, I do notice in both of these books that you're quite a connoisseur of beginnings and endings.
Mm-hmm.
The opening of The Colony of Unrequited Dreams is really a beautiful one. It's from Fielding's diary that Sheila Fielding.
Mm-hmm.
The characters call each other by their last names. And not to, spread the net of illusion too wide, it gave me more pleasure than anything I can think of since The Magnificent Ambersons, a book that also begins
Thanks.
With a wide tapestry of the past.
Mm-hmm.
And she's telling us about the parrots in the masts of the ship that mm-hmm. are coming from where are they coming from? Barbados.
Yeah, from the West Indies. Yeah.
Trading rum, bringing back salt fish, and about the boys, urchins.
Crosswalk sweepers, yeah.
Yeah, and the whole context of a place in the 19th century is recreated by her. It's a world she no longer lives in.
Mm-hmm.
To what extent does this recreation represent the writer's inclination to recreate yours?
That's exactly really the point. I think you put your finger on it. I put that section where I do. It's a kind of overture to the book. It sets the tone, and it sets also the scope of the book. It tells the reader that, if you think of the opening of Paradise Lost, where he declares that, my mission is nothing less than to explain the ways of God to men. Fielding is telling the reader through me that that I'm attempting here a big book with big themes. But that recreation by Fielding of the St. John's of pre-Confederation and the St. John's of pre-industrialization is in itself an act of imagination. I mean, that all of that is before my time, and so there's as much, I did research it, but to get the tone and to get the flavor, if you talk to a million people, it won't get it for you. You get it through language, and you get it, you create all that through language. And so in that sense, it's like any work of imagination, even though its intent is to recreate, it's almost an illusion of recreation. The point is to make the reader feel that they know what it's like. But of course, the day after, Fielding might have described it a different way. It's creational in that sense.
Now, both of these books, The Colony of Unrequited Dreams and The Divine Ryans, they're comic novels in a certain sense, but comic novels set among Stoic communities.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a kind of play between wisecracking characters and characters who would prefer to remain silent.
Yeah, I think Divine Ryans is, the proportion of comedy to pathos or drama is greater towards comedy in Divine Ryans than it is in Colony. This is actually true also of my first book called The Story of Bobby O'Malley. I always like to counterpoint a stoic. One character will be a commentator on things, but not a person of action. And then the other character will be a person of action who generally toes the social line. But does not like to does not like self-examination or introspection or an examination of the society that they live in and are in part responsible for creating. I like that interplay and that the tension between the two kinds of characters. So that it forms a part of the colony of Unrequited Dreams, but that's you know, it's Smallwood and Fielding. Smallwood is the man of action or the person of action. You know, or he becomes that eventually in his life. He becomes the leader of Newfoundland. Fielding is someone who, in a way, is above, you know, the sort of vulgarity of politics. But at the same time, she, you know, she writes about it. She lives in a sort of one-room artist's garret and shadows Smallwood's career. So there is that constant tension between the two characters.
Because what I noticed in The Divine Ryans by my guest Wayne Johnston is that I'm reading along and it's a sort of relatively conventional comic novel, Woodhouseian, Amos, you know, a certain kind of tradition. And then, and yet there's a brooding underquality to it, mostly revealed in dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And the version of that underquality is represented in surface life by silence, by what the people aren't talking about. Mm-hmm. As we get to the climax of the book, a secret so far out of the range of the comic tone of the book is revealed, and I found myself fascinated by the strangeness of the join between this initiating revelation, in a sense, the facts that come before the book, and the kinds of repression and attempts at humor that this entire family have used in order not to discuss or diffuse the discussion of the past. And something of the same type works in the colony of Unrequited Dreams mm-hmm. in its relation to secrets. And I wanted to talk to you about that.
Draper Doyle has suppressed a memory of something that has happened. And in mock Freudian fashion, his uncle helps him remember. But all the characters in the book would rather, you know, bury things than talk about them. You know, it's like from The Postman Always Rings Twice, you know, talk makes things real. If you ignore things, they tend to go away.
Well, it starts to be a fully terrifying book because you realize that the book is halves are the metaphor for the book. There's a sister who's a nun, mm-hmm. and she's paralyzed from the waist down.
Yeah.
And the half of life that we spend in dreaming and the half life we spend right. unexamined seems to be what arises from the book afterwards. Mm-hmm. And I'm suggesting that something similar happens in the newer novel, The Colony of Unrequited Dreams.
Yeah, it's my view of human nature that everyone has not just secrets, but generally some of the things that are most important to people are things that only they know about. And that when they finally do fess up to these things, one of two things happens. It's either a tragedy or a great purgation and salvation for them. I just feel that that's what people are like. They withhold a lot, you know. They as much talking as it's hip to do these days about how people feel. I don't think people really tell each other much of what they feel, and they don't tell each other much of what their lives have really been like. You know, incidents happen to people, and you know they go home and never talk about them. And families have secrets that they would rather remain secret.
Now, there are two relevant areas. The first, literary. Although that notion of the buried life is common in the novel, it is rather startling that the Deptford novels of Robinson Davies and certain of the more recent novels of Margaret Atwood feature a delving of this kind, repressed memories, and often a kind of phantasmagorical way of arriving at the original figure of disruption. And I wondered, is that particular, or why is that particular to a certain part of Canadian fiction?
I think, you know, there are a lot of different possibilities. I think one of them, and this is not so much true of Newfoundland as it is of the rest of Canada, but, you know, the Protestant ethic is that, you know, you don't, you know, wash your dirty laundry in public. You keep these things secret. And, you know, in Davies' novels and in Atwood's novels, characters have to fight against this kind of almost a brainwashing to come to some sense of self. And I think the parallel between Canadian and Newfoundland, if I can separate Newfoundland fiction from Canadian just for a second, the parallel is, in my books, is especially Divine Rhymes, is Catholicism, which in a way has the same inhibiting aspect. You know, the religion says that your fealty is to, you know, not even so much God as it is to your local religious leaders, and they will tell you what to think and how to deal with the problems in your life. And, you know, it's and then you make that in Canadian literature, that gets made into a grotesque when writers make that larger and think of the world view, you know, in general, because that's how I think all societies operate. You know, an individual coming to self-realization in anything except a facile way is pretty much unheard of within tightly bound religious communities. And that's, you know, that's why you get a gothic treatment almost in some Canadian novels.
It's very interesting because I do notice that I haven't seen it in American literature, although one might go to Hawthorne, where there's this mixture of a linkage between historical telling and sexual repression, as if what one is attempting to unbury in the telling of the past is a moment of sexual rebellion that has been so buried that the consequence has been generations of repression and histories of repression.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's the, you know, the there are almost two poles really that you're talking about. I think one, you know, the reason sexuality is so important is that that's the most highly personal, individual aspect of the psyche, I suppose. And then on the other end of that, you have the collective, which would be history. And, you know, what all writers are trying to do is, you know, as writers, they're trying to emerge from under the tyranny of tradition of other writers. And as people, they're trying to, you know, unload the avalanche of history that falls on them. And, you know, I think an education in conventional terms works against any kind of you know, self-realization and sexual normalcy. And that's, you know, that's what, and because Canadian and Newfoundland society has been so restrained and at the same time weighs so heavily on tradition, you know, because what is always held out to you when you have a new idea, the reason not to do it is that it's never been done before, you know, and you get generations of examples of why something wasn't tried. And so you have to unload all of that. You have to come to terms with it somehow. And in The Colony of Unrequited Dreams, you know, as the title indicates, you know, there's this sense of a colony trying to emerge from a, you know, a history of unrequital at the same time as the characters are trying to emerge from it as well.
A final question. Now, Americans have been reading about Newfoundland in the work of Annie Proulx and Howard Norman, both of them American writers. And I know that in many cases, I've felt, in fact, when I've seen American writers using the techniques of magic realism, mm-hmm. I felt they belong to the South Americans. Mm-hmm. They're being stolen. You know, it's not fair. Since your book is a bit self-consciously a big book mm-hmm. about Newfoundland and inviting comparisons within it to War and Peace and Moby Dick, how have you felt about the outsiders who've been presenting Newfoundland to Americans before you?
I have no problem with it at all because I think what they do is what every writer does. They take a place and then they take a place and fictionalize it, even though they still call it, you know, what it's known as in real life. That's what historical fiction does with characters as well. But, you know, in the case of them doing it with Newfoundland, in Annie Proulx's book, a man visits Newfoundland and then decides to stay there. Well, that's, an entirely acceptable premise because she's not claiming to have lived there for 500 years. Or whatever. She was a visitor. He's a visitor. In Howard Norman's book, it's a different kind of way. But what Howard does, I think, is he creates a very stylized Newfoundland setting. For people who don't know anything about Newfoundland, it probably doesn't matter if he called it Newfoundland or Xanadu. Mm-hmm. For Newfoundlanders who might read it a different way, my suggestion to them would be to simply read it as they would read a book about Newfoundland written by Newfoundlanders and just see how convincing it feels as a book. You know, it's not a travel guide. It's not meant to show you where all the best restaurants are or, you know, get the dialect right because, you know, I really don't worry about such things. So I'm more concerned with whether or not a book succeeds in as literature than I am in whether or not it recreates, or has a sense of verisimilitude about it or has a fidelity to real life. It's, having that expectation almost goes against the premise of fiction, which is to invent and embellish and make up.
I've been speaking to Wayne Johnston, the author most recently of The Colony of Unrequited Dreams, published by Doubleday. His earlier novel, The Divine Ryans, has been published in paperback by Anchor. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Scott Fritz. Special production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse, Mouse.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.